Thanks, everyone, for joining us today for another NCBA Live briefing call. I'm Nathan Wilner, NCBA's Government Affairs Officer. Today's topic is part two of the CARES Act from a practical and economic standpoint, what businesses need to know during COVID-19. We're very fortunate to have back with us today for this follow-up discussion, John Fagan and Brendan Walsh with Markets Policy Partners. Markets Policy Partners' mission is to provide sophisticated financial market analysis that is independent, accessible, and actionable for a broad public and private sector audience. John Fagan was director of the U.S. Treasury's Markets Room from 2014 until 2018, and prior to that was a senior macro strategist for Discovery Capital Management, primarily responsible for Asian equity indexes, foreign exchange, and rates markets. Brendan Walsh was a senior analyst at Discovery Capital Management from 2006 to 2018, covering global financial institutions, and was part of the global macro team focusing on macro data, rates, foreign exchange, and equity indices. So thank you very much, guys, for getting back on the phone with us today to discuss what's still very much in play on the national scene. So I'm going to kick it off just to get things rolling. Basically, what have we learned so far from CARES 2.0 and 2.5, and will there be a 3.0?
Yeah, so thank you. Thank you very much for the kind introduction. And it's great to be back on. Yeah, what have we learned so far? I think so. Brendan and I are going to go back and forth on this a little bit. But as we joked before, one of the things we learned is these CARES Acts, these fiscal support acts are in pretty rapid cadence coming out of Capitol Hill. We saw the first few bills, which were much smaller scale, come out relatively early in the process, but the CARES Act, the $2.2 trillion CARES Act, came out on April 16th, which seems like a really long time ago, but it really isn't, and certainly in legislative time, the fact that they've gone from the CARES Act 2.0 to the sort of bridge version, whether call it CARES Act 3.0 or 2.5, however, Brendan and I were debating this, yeah. However you want to characterize it, that came out on April 27th, just a few weeks later. And this is warp speed for legislative actions on Capitol Hill. And certainly for anything this big, it's quite incredible. So that's one thing that we've learned. And we're not done yet. We're heading for the very next iteration, which is going to be larger than this last one, which came out at the end of April, but may not quite equal the size of the initial $2.2 trillion CARES Act, but is going to be, I think, of that order of magnitude, although we'll talk a little bit more about that.
So you do think another version will actually make its way through? I mean, I know they're talking about presenting one and proposing more legislation, but then you hear from the Republicans and Democrats not being able to come together. Do you think there will be a 3.0?
So as of yesterday, they have made for the second round, which is a $320 billion, they've made about 2.4 million loans, accounting for $181 billion. So on that pace, the 320 will be done probably by the end of this week. So yes, they're going to need more. There's probably 30 to 40 million businesses that are applying for the loans. So we've only made it about 5 million loans total. But there's a chance that this could just be a standalone approval and we don't have to have any riders, but I'm less optimistic this time than I was last time that the next tranche, we'll probably need another, say, $300 to $400 billion to meet the needs for all the lending. The problem is the states and municipalities are going to need a bailout, and that's a very partisan issue. So that, in the end, I do think the states get bailed out, but it's going to be a much more contentious negotiation.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and we've seen. The urgency was clearly what was spurring the urgency and the fears of this turning into a real cataclysm, and nobody knew how in mid-April some of the projections about about, you know, New York running out of ventilators and the most dire predictions there really focused the minds down in Washington, D.C. And as things have calmed down to some extent, we've seen some of the hot spots, infection rates in some of the real hot spots like New York and New Jersey leveling out. We have states going toward a fitful reopening and restarting. So in terms of public health outcomes, maybe we see is the, you know, the worst case scenario may have been avoided here.
When you look at the total data, the entire United States new cases have plateaued, but that's only because New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut and Massachusetts have decreased massively. When you take those four states, which were really the hot zones, we're still on a, you know, a 60 degree angle up. So all the states that are loosening are actually having accelerating infection rates. So I worry that new hotspots are being formed right now.
Yeah, and that's the kind of that has fed the way that people are absorbing these statistics and the focus on New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, the real hotspots, and the way that those falling curves have kind of have maybe lulled people into a little bit of complacency to some extent. Yeah. The markets obviously bouncing
disseminated across the whole country, which seems less shocking than dead bodies piling outside of Kettering.
And I can tell you, having worked as the director of the Treasury Markets Room for 4 years, policymakers watch the markets, and they respond to signals from the equity market and the equity market very directly, other markets as well. But the fact that we've got a rebound, some of the systemic risks in credit markets and some of the plumbing, that's calmed down, and the equity markets have come up pretty significantly off the bottom. Boy, does that take some of the urgency out of the policymakers' decision making, and that leads us to, as the urgency goes down, the perceived urgency goes down, the partisan rancor goes up, and so this next bill, you know, the battle lines are being drawn. We've seen some crosstalk. Clearly, Speaker Pelosi wants to have the House Democrats setting the agenda for this one, and as Brendan said, state and municipalities' support is going to feature prominently in the bill that they write. The White House is banging the drum on the payroll tax cut, which they didn't get into the first CARES Act, and it was rejected by House Democrats. But not only are they pushing for a return of the payroll tax cut, they're pushing for capital gains tax cuts. They're aligned with Mitch McConnell in pushing for liability restrictions for corporations that bring their employees back, and then those employees, if they get sick, then sue their employers. That's Mitch McConnell. Senate Majority Leader McConnell has emphasized that as a priority, perhaps a red line for him, that a must have. The White House has been very voluble on it as well. And the House Democrats are clearly not in favor of it. And so this is going to be a much more recognizable kind of partisan punch up over this next version of the CARES Act. And we'll see if the small business lending, which tends to have clear bipartisan support, if that ends up being, you know, done in a standalone kind of side pocket way, so they can get that done more quickly, or whether it gets dragged into the mire of what looks like could be a relatively relatively lengthy and difficult negotiation for this next round. Yeah.
And I think John made a really important point, that the fact that the stock market is up gives people it's a great indicator of happiness, essentially, and especially with policymakers. But in the end, the stock market is not the economy. The stock market is very forward-looking, and the reason the stock market's up a lot is because tech stocks have gone up and the Fed has pumped in a huge amount of liquidity. That does not mean the economy is doing well. We have 20 million new unemployed people. So a lot of this optimism is bad news for Main Street, because there's a sense that things are turning, but they really aren't. We're still on lockdown for the most part, and even states that are "quote unquote" reopening, it's very incremental, and most people are staying self quarantined on their own. So, you know, restaurants aren't going back to, you know, full occupancy. They're 25% max, and most restaurants don't even bother reopening because they can't make the economics work.
Yeah, so, you know, so you kind of mentioned a little bit about this, but, you know, what I'm hearing is that different segments of the economy are being treated differently in these relief acts. I mean, could you comment on, you know, maybe how big corporations are being treated versus the small business applicants for loans and grants and the PPP programs? What are you seeing in the disparity between those two segments?
So it's partially true and it's partially untrue. The big banks are kind of getting a bad rap on this one, where the smaller banks were able to approve all their clients very quickly. But that's just because smaller banks have less clients. So
the big banks, Brendan?
The big banks are getting a little bit of a bad rap because they have so many clients that they just haven't got all of the applied loans out the door yet. And big banks have huge corporations and they also have small, you know, customers. So there's a sense that the big banks favored the their biggest clients over their smallest clients, which actually isn't true. They kind of did it as it is, but the big banks have so many more clients that they still have a backlog, where smaller banks don't have a backlog because they were able to process all the loans because they just don't have as many clients. So when you look at the data from Bank of America or JP Morgan Chase, they have made by far the most small loans just by simply because they have the most clients, but they still have a huge backlog of small clients that haven't got their loans.
Yeah. The reality is that with 30, as Brendan said, 30 or 40 million applicants, that's just, you're never going to reach them all. And it is on a first come, first serve basis. The first $350 billion really was on a first come, first serve basis. That went out extremely quickly, and it was, the average loan size was larger than people expected, and it made they made about a million. I guess I don't know what the final was, but at the estimate,
it was about
that
2 million in the end. Yeah,
yeah, about 2 million loans, which was smaller. We heard 3.5 that they were expecting to make out of that, but it ended up being smaller. And so with this, when they re-upped it at the end of April, the bill had some certain set asides. I think it was $60 billion specifically earmarked for smaller lenders, and to try to reach those, you know, to try to reach down into the smaller, you know, the less large institutions. And to try to reach some of those Main Street businesses that may not have a lending relationship with a place like Bank of America and so forth. So, they're trying, but it's
better to be big. Yeah. So in terms of the second, the round two, so 1.1 million of those loans were made to corporations or companies with over $50 billion in assets. So the big companies got half of this round. 10 to 50 billion got about 340,000 loans, and then less than 10 billion in assets was 900,000. And obviously there's a big difference between having, you know, $9 billion in assets and having, you know, $400 in assets, which that group it would include both.
Yeah. So you were talking about Main Street, but that kind of brings me to my next topic, is this Main Street lending program. Maybe you could inform our listeners as to what it is and why, you know, what are the important factors to know about that program and how it affects small business.
So this one, we're still learning the details, and it's being set up. This one is run by the Fed. In conjunction with the Treasury. So the Treasury is going to put up about $500 million in the first loss tranche. And then the Fed will essentially buy these loans. They're going to make loans, and then the Fed will buy them. But the Fed's not supposed to lose money, where the PPP program is designed to not be paid back as long as you keep your people employed. So this one's a little trickier, and it's not exactly clear how successful it will be in terms of implementing it. But it is $600 billion that is potentially out there to kind of go alongside the PPP program.
That brings up an interesting point. The Main Street lending really is designed to be paid back. Whereas if you ask policymakers, they would want to forgive the PPP loan. The Payroll Protection Program loan is designed to be forgiven. That's what they want it to achieve. And it's however, what the requirements that allow it to be forgiven are keeping the same headcount over a particular length of time. That was June 30th. I think that's been extended. And the confusion about what counts as an employee, we've heard from small business lenders and people that are very close to this issue and really in the nitty, in the weeds of it, in the nitty gritty. Small business owners that want to take this money are very careful about their debts, and they don't want to game the system. They don't want to be taking advantage of it. They always want to make good on any debts that they have, but they can't be sure that they're going to be able to meet the conditions for forgiveness. And that's been a tension that we've seen. And you know what the policymakers want it to be, they want it to be a grant ultimately, but they structured it as a loan with these conditions to try to, you know, incentivize the behavior that they wanted. But you know, there have been some definitional and some other clunky frictions on that point, and it's caused some hesitancy and confusion on the part of some of the potential borrowers.
So, you know, you're talking about how businesses are apprehensive of taking those funds or not knowing necessarily how to list them on their balance sheets. I mean, they'd like to list them as grants, but they're technically loans. I mean, what other kinds of pitfalls or issues would you see with the, you know, PPP loans that businesses need to look at from, you know, from a balance sheet perspective and, you know, a viability perspective for their businesses?
One issue that a lot of small businesses are running into is their workers don't want to come back because within the CARES First Act, the federal government threw in an extra $600 per week on top of your state unemployment claim. So about 40% of the people are actually making more money now than they were at their job. So it doesn't really make sense to go back, be a line cook and kind of risk your life to take a pay cut. So that then you the owner of the business, you're supposed to have them employed by June. So that's kind of a loophole that I guess needs to be fixed if it's safe for people to go back to work. But a lot of people don't want to take the loan and then not be able to meet their mandate of hiring people back because the people don't want to come back.
Go ahead.
Some of the other pitfalls, I don't know if we would count it as a pitfall, but the legislation was structured so that some of the certain, like we've obviously all heard the blowback on Shake Shack. They actually called it the Shake Shack exemption, the Lakers, Harvard University, and some of these other borrowers at the PPP program that were allowed in through the requirement, you know, through the conditions of the program, were then met with some bad press and some some recriminations for jumping ahead of some of the small businesses that might otherwise need it more than they do. Shake Shack and the Lakers quickly gave the money back. I think there are some other businesses like that, franchises and larger businesses that did it as well. Harvard, there was some he said, she said around that. and I don't think Harvard ended up taking the PPP money either, but it was if you're designing the program, you don't want to, and you can foresee these problems, you want to be able to design it so that those don't occur. That obviously didn't happen. But also if you're taking it, then I assume that the sharp folks at Shake Shack, the Lakers and Harvard knew they were taking some kind of, risk at getting into line with some of the other small businesses. And then, when they, they probably weren't terribly, they probably weren't entirely surprised when they got some bad press and had to give it back. But yeah, I don't know anything. But Brent, since Brent and I are Celtics fans, we've joked that we're thoroughly unsurprised by the conduct of the Lakers in the circumstance.
Yeah, so I mean, that's some really good insight on how the program was set up, and that those are always the unintended consequences of legislation when things are not thought through carefully and put out quickly. So what would be at this point your general economic observations, on the outlook? Will the CARES programs have long-lasting effects on the U.S. economy? Is this a very short-term lived, you mentioned the stock market looking a little better these days, that some states are confusing, it appears, economic increases with the health crisis concerns. I mean, where do you see things going? If you had to predict long-term what our economy is going to look like over the next several months and the next year.
Yeah, it's a really challenging thing for both economists and market participants and, just average people to try to figure out the impact of this money. And we know that it's with the magnitude of the downturn that we're experiencing, no policymaker would honestly tell you that this is enough to fill the hole and to make up for what is being lost. And that's not just in the economic sense, but obviously in the human lives and public health sense and so forth. But so ultimately, when we look back at the success of this program, we're going to have to, we're going to have to assess it on a, but-for basis. But for this PPP program, things would have been worse. Well, that's really hard to do. Also, market participants are very used to large-scale monetary stimulus by the Federal Reserve. That was the star of the stimulus show back in 2008, 2009. And Fed stimulus tends to have a very immediate effect. It's instant gratification. They start, the Fed starts buying credit, or even says that they're going to start buying credit, and the credit markets will magically react, right? I mean, it's like instantaneous. Fiscal support just doesn't work that way. And it's a guessing game as to exactly how much of a lift it's going to give us and how much of a bridge it's going to provide for small businesses and employees in the real economy to get through these very tough days. So it's the markets obviously have kind of, if you look at it from an index perspective, the equity market has taken the glass half full approach. But as Brendan mentioned, if you look between, if you look underneath the hood, the character of the gains have been very concentrated in your big tech winners. Netflix, the couch potato trade, is always winning with Netflix these days. And Amazon, obviously, that stock has been up at record highs and is gaining on the year. And some of the other, big tech plays are really doing almost all, not all the work, but they're doing the lion's share of the work. We've seen oil prices bounce up, and that's lifted very depressed energy sector stocks. And that sort of flattered the overall returns of the index here. So don't take the index at face value necessarily as to what it's saying about the economy. And certainly, right, if you glance over at the Treasury market, which tends to be the market where that it has a better track record for predicting what's going to happen in the economy, it's still the yields and the Treasury yield curve are very consistent with a long, low, and slow kind of halting recovery. The 10-year Treasury yield, some of this is obviously down to the Fed, but the 10-year Treasury yield is 71 basis points. That's still really, really low. And commodity markets, although we've, as I said, we've had a little bit of bounce off multi-decade lows in oil prices, commodities are very depressed still. If you look at the equity market, the growth, the parts of it that are very leveraged to growth, like financials, have been underperforming and lagging. Industrials, materials, those that real economy kind of stocks, traditional economy kind of stocks. So there's a lot of uncertainty. Everybody's hoping that we have a solid and decent recovery over the next couple of quarters. But the expectation is that even with all the stimulus, a V-shaped recovery is just not in the cards. And we're hoping that you know, a gradual improvement is going to be enough alongside the stimulus for us to get to the other side without significantly more disruption.
Yeah, because normal economic behavior, it doesn't really count this time because you have to factor in the virus. So it basically everything depends on infection rates and how quickly we can get either a drug that can combat it or a vaccine. And, you know, late in the year is really best case for, you know, mass distribution of a vaccine. So, you know, economic behavior is just going to be muted even in any scenario, even if every state says you can do whatever you want, most people aren't going to do whatever they want.
And yeah, shopping's not too much fun these days.
Yeah.
Those of us that might have enjoyed a day out at the shops definitely has a higher stress component.
Yeah. And finally, I mean, just to kind of piggyback on the comment about shopping and the reopening of the economy, from your perspective, do you think that upon the discovery of a vaccine or, you know, appropriate treatment, do you think the economy is going to come back quickly at that point? Or do you think people are going to be very cautious in their spending habits and business enterprises?
I think behavior is going to go back mostly to what it was. We had the Spanish flu and then we had the roaring 20s. So, you know, everyone says that this time is different and everything's going to be different. You know, I think once it's safe to go to restaurants and bars, people are going to be really excited to do it. I think certain things, this pandemic and closing has accelerated the bankruptcy of some companies that were going to go bankrupt anyways, especially the old line retail. Nordstrom's was having a hard time and the Gap was having a hard time before this. This just kind of accelerated their demise. I think, some technologies that we were probably going to adopt ubiquitously in 5 to 10 years, that time frame is going to be accelerated, like Zoom calls. I think, you know, business travel, we're still going to do business travel, but I think we won't do as much as we used to, where you can just sit at your desk and do a meeting rather than have to fly to, Hong Kong. But the question on the individual spending and saving side, that's really dependent on how long and how much damage this does. If we remain at 10-15% unemployment, that's the kind of thing that takes a long time to undo. And a lot of these, especially the restaurants, I've already said, you know, we can't open, you know, no matter what, it's over. So I do think there'll be a lot of damage.
We're engaged with, we spend a lot of time engaging with policymakers at various agencies and up on Capitol Hill and in the administration and discussing some of these issues. And one of the things that is not necessarily visible right now, but is certainly in the line of thinking is the, if we don't have this binary, you know, not all vaccines are a perfect 100% cure. As someone who had their flu shot and got the flu a few years ago, you know how everybody knows how these things can be a little bit of slippage in them. But when you have a situation like this and planning for that longer term economic supports in Washington, D.C., you know, Infrastructure Week has been a total punchline. But when you think about what the government can do to try to have, if there is a component of this huge burst of unemployment and joblessness that we have, if some of that does become chronic or threatens to become chronic, policymakers are thinking about some of the longer term support aspects and things that they can do, whether it's something like, a federally supported infrastructure program, which provides, yeah, provides jobs on that front. Whether it's poring over the regulations and in a really micro, fine tooth comb level, to try to see where they can bust through red tape and try to make life easier for small businesses that would be the engine of any all the recovery and hiring. And so this is our opportunity to ask and solicit if you do have ideas in your particular space, anybody on the call that has thoughts about how to grease the skids of their particular sector, how to make life easier. That's something that policymakers are listening for, and you can either send it through the channels you're familiar with. Please send it to us, or just make it be known. The government's listening. They don't always have their stethoscope in the right place. So sometimes you have to make a little bit of an extra effort to suggest things at a time like this.
That's really great advice, and I think it's really appreciated that you're taking the time to do this. I got a couple of questions. Do you guys have another few minutes to answer some questions that I've received from the audience?
Sure.
Okay. One question was, you mentioned, and if you recall, a deadline of June 30th that it may be extended. So one of the listeners wants to know what you were referring to.
Oh, so this was the trigger for the date was the June 30th was the day by which, if you had the same headcount, not necessarily the same employees, but the same headcount that you went into the pandemic with, that would be the trigger for the main criteria for getting your PPP loan forgiven. And there was some, you know, there were some questions and ambiguities about what counts as an employee. Are we talking, you know, there sometimes there's a blurring between full-time and part-time. There were some questions about whether part-time and some part-time employees might count for that headcount, might be a part of that headcount. What is it a bright line date on June 30th? What happens if you've got someone quits on June 30th? there's a lot of question around that kind of that part of the program. And so I think the expectation that it will be extended out, I think, is consistent with the public health, this longer tail of the pandemic. And obviously small businesses need to be, it's going to be a relatively gradual reopening in some places, in a lot of places. And so June 30th, I don't think is going to be the marker in the sand. So we're going to keep our ears to the ground as to how that particular condition is refined and revised. We expect that to be clarified.
All right, well, thanks. I'm sure that that does answer the question. Here's another question for you. If an attorney or someone has filled out one of these loans, an SBA loan or PPP loan for a client or for themselves, what would you suggest to be the main focus to ensure the applications are accurate and correct so they don't run into any problems? To the extent that you know, what would you think would be the kinds of things that people need to make sure are accurate?
Yeah, this is where we have the ask your attorney who are experts in the. I think really one of the key issues is really about headcount going in and how to get that right, and making sure that the understanding is clear and that all the assumptions are right. I know there's I'm aware that there's ambiguity in the legislation, but making sure that is disclosed with the greatest precision. I think is a threshold issue, because obviously that's the setting that right is how you get the loan turned into a grant. And so I think that's really one of the major aspects.
Yeah. And I would also say they did this quickly because they had to do it quickly. We needed to get this money out the door right away. The intention wasn't to make it confusing and try to catch people down the road and, put you in jail. So what the current mandates are now, if it's clear that it's just not going to work that way, they can be adjusted. It's not set in stone.
Okay. And one last question. So many of our members are small law firms. They're not corporations or LLCs. They're independent contractors. What advice could you give to the independent contractors who are listening about these grants and loans?
There was initially a thought that that contractors could be counted as this I think is when we talked with some experts on this, they specifically mentioned that this was something that may have been an oversight in the initial legislation. And there was ambiguity. There was a question as to whether independent contractors really counted as, you know, whether you could count them as employees. By the time this was clarified, a lot of other businesses jumped. This is a first come, first serve basis. So if you have the problem is if you have an uncertainty like that, you're an independent contractor, you felt as though the business necessarily you were working for might be putting in for you, and then you delayed your own application, then you ended up further back in the line than you would be otherwise. And I think that is just, so we heard from our friend who's a specialist in this, his lawyer up in New York, and he mentioned that this was one of the regretful aspects of the initial drafting of the law, that this wasn't set out in a more clear fashion. So I wish we had a more satisfactory answer for that.
Well, thank you very much for taking questions that were off script and handling them well. And I know that everyone listening is very impressed and appreciative of the time and information that you've given them. So thank you so much for a very informative discussion today. That comes to the end of our time. So please visit creditorsbar.org for additional resources and information regarding COVID-19 and legislation that's affecting your businesses. Join us Thursday, May 7th at 2 p.m. Eastern for an NCBA legal learning webinar. The CFPB proposed a model demand letter, Why Should I Worry About Mine? Information on joining that webinar can be found at creditorsbar.org/webinars, and information about it will be sent out via bulletin and other information. And there will also be a recording of today's call for those who were unable to listen or want a colleague to listen to it as well. So again, John and Brendan, thank you so much, and wish everyone a healthy and safe day as we navigate through these unprecedented times. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us on.